Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
I've been reading a book about Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, which is always interesting. And, of course, they're very closely associated with the demon drink, as you know, I remember. And Richard Burton, in particular, used to take the stage while, you know, what we would describe as loaded, you know, and go through an entire kind of Shakespearean performance. Anyway, the story in this book is that in the early 50s, he was appearing at the Old Vic in Othello with John Neville. And the idea was that the two of them would alternate the two key roles, Othello and Iago, between different performances. Now, that was obviously in the days when white actors blacked up to play Othello. And apparently one night, both Burton and Neville appeared on stage blacked up. And according to Willie Donaldson, the writer, neither of them noticed.
Because they were so pissed, is it?
I don't know.
That's incredible.
But listen, that story can't be true. But, you know, it contains a germ of truth about it, doesn't it?
There's like no smoke without fire somewhere. Okay. There's got to be. It's based on it's the sort of thing that we have. And we want to believe it.
Want to believe it, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I was thinking about apocryphal tales, or how kind of, you know, real incidents grow kind of apocryphal wings, don't they, over the years. When we were talking this week to Harold Bronson, the American writer and man about the music business, who was involved in the launch of Rhino Records as a reissue label and used to write for Billboard and Rolling Stone and all kinds of people, and he's got a book out of his kind of diaries of his time doing that. And he talked about coming to London in 1972 and interviewing Mickey Most, the producer. Mickey Most, a man always very close to my heart, always intrigued by Mickey Most. And Mickey Most, he was in a very forthright interview, really, where he talks about all the people he's produced in the 60s and how he very often didn't get on with them at all.
He falls out with nearly all of them in the end.
Nearly all of them.
Because they won't listen to his good advice, actually, it's the truth. I mean,
well, he
was right and they're wrong, you know.
Well, you know, history is written by the winners, you know, as they say. And, you know, it depends who last got to the microphone, really. Because I was thinking about House of the Rising Sun, which I note, Mark, was recorded 50 years ago, pretty much this you know, couple of weeks, you know, this period we're in now.
Which is a fantastic story.
It's an incredible story.
You saw them on that tour, didn't you?
Well, we were only talking about it the other week with Rich Thompson, and then we were talking to Steve Howe out of Yes about it, because they too also saw this tour, you know, with Chuck Berry, Carl Perkins, and the Animals were the kind of up-and-comers on that tour. And And they started including House of the Rising Sun, which they'd heard in a folk arrangement. They started including their rock arrangement of this thing in their live set. And the live set in a package store would only be about four numbers, I would imagine. But they decided this was a good way to make an impact. And even though it was a rather adventurous thing to do, because it was more than 4 minutes long. And pop records that were more than 4 minutes long were pretty much unheard of at the time. Now, according to Mickey Mouse, I wanted to record it. They didn't want to record it. According to them, they wanted to record it. He didn't want to record it. I simply I tend to believe him.
Because there's nothing worse than having a huge hit that you resisted the idea of recording in the first place because you just feel a bit embarrassed. You almost don't want it to be successful to be proved right. But anyway, let's believe
absolutely.
It.
So they're in the middle of a nationwide tour, package tour, up and down the country, and it's decided that they ought to come down to London. This is the tale. They ought to come down to London and quickly record House of the Rising Sun and get it out as a single before anybody else does it. Because don't forget, this was a time when if there was a good idea around, somebody would pinch it. And anyway, he brought them down on the sleeper train. Can you imagine what a miserable experience that would be in the early 60s? It wouldn't have been first class at all. Brought down on the sleeper. They arrive at Euston Station like 5 a.m. or something. And these are the apocryphal wings that the story has grown, you know, because I've always attended to this story when it's been told by any former member of the Animals or anybody who had anything to do with it or whatever. The last version I read, somebody said, oh, we commandeered a British Rail cart.
And right, they pushed all their equipment to in the rain. Let's imagine it.
Absolutely, it would be the rain.
At five in the morning,
down through Bloomsbury to the recording studios, which was Delaney, which is in Kingsway, so it's not near Holborn. And the session is booked to begin at, let's just remind ourselves of this, 8 o'clock.
Yeah,
8 o'clock.
According to Harold, they were out of the studio at 8:20, which I think can't be true because
according
they had
to Mickey
set
Mouse,
up and they balanced the sound. And,
according to Mickey Mouse, 15 minutes they had House of the Rising Sun in the can. They'd done it.
You know? There were two versions, weren't there?
Was there? All right.
And they used the first one.
And, you know, then pretty much they're. You know, they're at a bit of a loose end for the rest of the 3-hour session, really. Push the cart back up
They went straight to the station, got back on the train and went and joined the tour, didn't they? Back out again. That's why they did it 8 a.m.
Absolutely. And, of course, the remarkable thing is, what a great record that is. What an unbelievably great record. Made under, you know, what are presumably the least sympathetic, congenial standards, circumstances you can possibly imagine anything being, you know. And I was just reading about it. And, of course, the thing to remember about it is that when Bob Dylan heard it, he pretty much stopped the car he was in, didn't he?
He said, that's how I should have done it, didn't he?
Because he'd done it on his first solo album. He'd done it just a folky version. And you imagine if within, 2 years, you hear something, you think, oh, my God, that's going to change the world. You know, and what I did was kind of inadequate next to that, you know. And so following that, that's when Bob Dylan starts using electric instruments on his recordings.
But what about that solo, Dave?
Oh, my God.
I mean, we have a theory, don't we, between the two of us, that is, am I right, the greatest solo ever recorded?
I think it's certainly the greatest thing on a pop record you can possibly imagine. That's Alan Price playing the Vox Continental organ, which brought down on the British Railways cart from Euston, and
which has a strange swirling texture to it because it's a waltz, isn't it?
Yes.
The Rising Sun, it's in three time. And it kind of swirls about and it builds in intensity. And he plays these little figures, doesn't he? Higher and higher up, it's fantastic, and still plays the tune. It's gorgeous.
And it's contained in, you know, it won't be very long at all because, you know, you listen to House on the Rising Sun nowadays by contemporary standards, it doesn't sound long at all. At the time, it seemed really long. You hadn't heard a pop record that went beyond 3 minutes. You know, that was pretty much unheard of. But even when I hear it today, I still have to just stop and concentrate on it because it's absolutely fantastic solo. And I think it's as great a solo as anything that's ever been on a pop record. And I don't know, unless you know better.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Well, you were talking last week with Alex about Taylor Swift's new album coming out and how critics didn't dare say anything remotely negative about it. And it was just a really interesting quote from our old pal Neil Tennant, who was interviewed on, I think it was The Guardian evening, the event that he did. And he talked about how he was disappointed by Taylor Swift's records. He said that... So to have a successful pop career now, you have to have a series of relationships which are amazing and then break up tragically. In the world of pop, people don't write songs like Karma Chameleon anymore. I thought it was really interesting because when we talked to him in our podcast about a month ago, he was talking about this whole thing about everything's about identity now.
Yeah.
You know, and it's true because pop musicians are very like comedians. That what they do in the first sort of, you know, they establish straight away, this is who I am. This is what I represent. And this is what you have to connect with. I thought that was a good point because I don't remember feeling that you had to have a kind of personal connection with the people whose music you like. But I think that's probably true now. And I think people expect Taylor Swift to write songs that are a soundtrack to the real life story of Taylor Swift rather than to have philosophical points to make or, do you know what I mean, or perspectives to offer. And I thought he had a point, but also he's very... It's quite courageous, isn't it?
That's the thing that makes...
To say anything contrary, because I'm sure Neil is now getting bombarded with, the lynch mob of Riot.
That's the way this story came to me. I came across that on social media, and it was pretty much, Neil Tennant, you'll never guess what he's only gone and said.
Yeah.
And I thought...
Neil said was, her records are disappointing. They could be better.
I thought, what have we come to in popular music?
Yeah.
You know, when you can't
what
say
is Taylor Swift's
like...
Billie Jean, he said, isn't it? Is it Shake It Off? I listened to that the other day, and it's not Billie Jean, is it?
Well, no.
That's fair enough.
No, absolutely. And it's... but I suppose it's all a product of identity, isn't it? You know, that you if you are less than impressed by a record, that sort of tends to mean you're less than impressed with a person.
Yeah.
And which is a slightly different thing, isn't it, really? You know, and where records are supposed to embody, it's supposed to be somebody telling their truth. Isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
We all have our truth now. And if we have our truth, it's not to be slighted in any way because it's ours.
and it's disrespectful to it's not allow disrespectful. Me to have my truth, even if you
Absolutely.
Don't agree with it.
Absolutely. Whereas all he's saying is she's not really as good as probably she ought to be.
Yeah.
I think.
And but, whacking out a double album instead of a really good single album probably isn't going to help that, but there we are.
But, you know, she has... Here's the interesting thing, it seems to me. She has a greater level of personal devotion than I can remember anybody in pop music ever having. I think those people who flock to Taylor Swift, they adore Taylor Swift. Is that right, Alex? They call her mother. I think Alex told me.
They do, yeah, that's right.
It's kind of like it's almost like a religious thing, you know what I mean?
It's true. They don't seem to be able to differentiate within Taylor Swift the good, the bad, and the indifferent, or whatever. They just generally applaud and endorse everything she does.
But I go further than that. They adore her.
Yeah.
They absolutely adore her. And adoration is the point. You know what I mean? The music is just a kind of neither in nor there. The adoration is kind of what gets you there. You buy into the whole thing, you know. And so I think she's personally more popular than anybody I can ever remember being. I mean, because, you know, somebody like Michael Jackson was absolutely huge, and his music still is really huge, but his personal popularity took a dive very quickly, didn't it? You know, it was less invested in him and more in the stuff he did, I think. Whereas in her case, it's her. She's the kind of...
And it's just interesting that people express that loyalty by threatening and abusing anybody. I was watching a news clip about the Trump court case that's going on at the moment, and they interviewed a Trump supporter, this very strange woman in a baseball cap, and she said, if he doesn't win this case, she said, we will take to our guns and there will be civil war. And I thought, that's the kind of strange, it's that same threat, isn't it? It's the idea that if you do the wrong thing here, you'll pay for it. That's what's hanging over anybody reviewing
I don't think Taylor's fans have quite gone that far.
No, but there's a certain element. It was the Paste magazine. You pointed out the Paste magazine reviewed her album anonymously because they were worried about getting a backlash from the fans, weren't they?
It's just incredible.
They just had to take this person's name off because they just didn't want anyone finding out where they lived or where they parked their car, you know.
You think, you know, it's one of those moments where you think, pop music, has it gone too far?
And in terms of popularity, it struck me it's 40 years, pretty much, I think, to the day, since Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And that was an amazing year, 1984. Frankie Goes to Hollywood were all over that year, weren't they? They had three number one records, never off the radio, never off the telly, huge presence in the fashion world with the Frankie Say, Catherine Hamlet shirts, completely dominated all the music press, because it wasn't just the pop press, wasn't it? It was the gay press, it was the NME, it was kind of everything. They were incredibly fashionable and weirdly disappeared very soon after. But I just wondered if there'd been any group who stamped themselves over a 12-month period as comprehensively as that since the Beatles, actually, and since then. Can you think of anyone? I mean, the Oasis, Blur, Ed Sheeran.
Well, the Monkees for a period in sort of, what, 67, 68.
Yeah.
They were pretty much ubiquitous, and also they were on a weekly TV show and so forth. But yeah, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, I think you're probably right, because... The thing about Frankie is that they did something that I think is pretty hard to do nowadays, is they came out of music and they just dominated loads of other areas as well, didn't they? You know,
completely.
They came out of
fashion and
subculture and suddenly they were absolutely everywhere. They were
dance music, club culture, exactly, politics.
Yeah.
There was just elements. Was the Two Tribes, the original Sleeve had... Reagan and there was the Reagan and Chernenko, wasn't there?
The
original Sleeve had Margaret Thatcher on it, and DJs were very, very, very cautious about them because of they thought there'd be coded messages in there that they shouldn't be.
Funny that Chernenko, what was his first name? Konstantin, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Konstantin Chernenko, the relatively short-lived leader of the Soviet Union, is now largely remembered for being played by an actor. In the video for Two Tribes, isn't he? Is other than that, he's kind of slipped the world's mind, hasn't he? Really, who was it? Andropov, Chernenko, and they both died in short order. Is that right?
I can't remember how he wasn't there for long, was he?
He wasn't there for long, just long enough to be famous on the Frankie thing. And it's very funny, actually. I was thinking about this again this week. My wife's a teacher. And she came home from some parent-teacher's kind of music thing with all the kids, whatever. And they'd all had souvenir T-shirts. They were all pretty much like Frankie Say, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that still hangs on 40 years later. Those kids won't know that at all. But the reason that when you want to do a one-off T-shirt, that's the design signature, you know what I mean? All because of Frankie Say, you know.
Entirely.
It's absolutely extraordinary.
I read a little interview with Holly not long ago, Holly Johnson. He was talking about the making of Relax and how aggrieved the group were that they weren't really on these records. You know, that there was this band, five-piece band, and they get signed to ZTT, and Trevor Horn hears the tapes and goes, fine, leave this to me, you know, and then brings in all his...
You go to the pub.
The art of noise. You guys, you can go to the pub. Here's a tenor. See how far that'll go. Go and have a game of darts. Go and play bar billiards for 3 weeks. And, yeah, he got in various members of the Art of Noise, and in Steve Howe of Yes. That's the irony. Steve Howe of Yes. Everything that Frankie Goes to Hollywood were meant to be opposed to. And they make Relax, and the boys were... Holly's obviously singing it, you know, but the other boys aren't on it. And they complained about this, and so Trevor had recorded the four of them, the other four, jumping into a swimming pool and included that sound sample at the end of Relax.
He did,
just so they could feel they were actually on the record. That was a great... It's very symbolic of the 80s, the new way forward.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there we'll take a short break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Word Podcast, two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
I must just mention, any listeners who are in the accountancy fraternity, there's an interesting little podcast somebody sent me yesterday called Creative Accounting, done by a guy called Dan Simmons. And in it, he interviews his father, David Simmons, who was the accountant for Culture Club, Bob Marley and the Wailers, I forget who else, but notably Peter Green. And so the we thought was the apocryphal tale of Peter Green threatening his accountant with a shotgun because at the point in 1969 when he wanted to give away his money. It turns out it's true, Mark, doesn't it?
Absolutely, completely true. It's actually, it's really interesting to listen to.
It is really interesting.
Because, you know, this guy talks about the fact that, David Simmons, that he'd heard, I think it was in 1977, he'd heard that Peter Green had got a gun, or Peter Green got in touch, didn't he? He said, I've got a gun, and I don't want any more of my royalties, which were pretty substantial.
Huge.
He'd already said to him, you know, stop giving me the money and give away my money. And he said the problem there was that if he gave the money away, it would have been irresponsible.
Yeah, of course.
And would have lost his practice. If he didn't give the money away, he was not following the client's instructions.
Absolutely.
So what he did is he set up a trust, at which point Peter Green's dad rang up and he said, my son wants to give all his money to charity. Remind him that charity begins at home, which is good. But anyway, then he hears that Peter Green is on his way to see him with a shotgun. He goes to the Savile Row police station. One assumes the same Savile Row police station is so central in the Beatles Get Back movie, and says, this guy's on his way to see me. As indeed he was, wasn't he? And they eventually surround his house, I think. And
Well, then they got him a while later anyway. It's interesting to listen to, because it's a reminder of the fact that, you know, pop groups, remember them, kids. Pop groups, you know, a bunch of people who don't think about money at all until suddenly there's a load of money, and then very often have kind of mad schemes about what to do with it, which they insist upon to their accountant, who, if they're patient and experienced like David Simmons, they just sit there and go, yeah, all right, I'll see to it, and then go away and do something far more sensible with it, you know, to make sure that they hang on to it. So, yeah, you can just find that in the where you normally find your podcasts, Creative Accounting.
It's good.
Worth hearing. What else were we going to talk about? Oh, yes, the extraordinary report about the book trade. This has just emerged recently, hasn't it? It was a piece of work done in the United States a couple of years ago, I think, when there was a proposal for Penguin Random House, who are the biggest book publisher in the world, to take over Simon & Schuster, who are not quite so big, but quite substantial.
Which would have made a 48% share of the market.
Absolutely.
It was considered to be a monopoly and it wasn't allowed to go through.
And so there was a kind of congressional investigation of the book business, out of which they got loads and loads of people senior in the book business giving evidence, being just very forthright about how the book business worked. And this is all over the internet in the last week or so. And, what's the great revelation? That the overwhelming majority of books don't make any money at all, which...
It said 96% of books sell less than 1,000 copies.
And this is United
That's
States.
Chilling, isn't it?
It's chilling, but it's sort of not surprising, really. No. Because I think... A lot of this transfers over quite easily to what used to be called the record business.
Yeah.
That the overwhelming majority of records put out never made any money at all, Or they certainly didn't make their advance back, So when people...
20% of authors make their advance back, don't they? Which I thought was more than I expected, actually.
But the advances will vary, they'll go from just kind of nominal advances to many millions paid to, former presidents or whatever.
Yeah.
All the kind of people who don't need any money at all, actually. But I think you could draw a line between this and the record business, and it would be pretty much the same. It works on the basis that they try millions of things, and that handful of things that work pay for if they're lucky, all the other stuff that doesn't work.
Most of the things that work are celebrity memoirs, aren't they? It's signing famous people.
This is it, which as they say in this evidence, they increasingly just target the individuals. So basically, how do you successfully publish? Well, you sit there and watch telly. And you go, oh, she's new, he's new, and you approach them, and if you're lucky, they've got some tragedy somewhere in the background, because if somebody just writes, a celebrity biography, autobiography about, well, it's all gone swimmingly for me. I went to
my charmed life.
Nobody wants that at all, I do think it's interesting that the most recent example of this in the last week or so is the Rebel Wilson book, in which she makes allegations about Sacha Baron Cohen, who she worked with on one of his films, allegations which have had to be redacted in the UK version. They aren't there at all. But clearly, it's done part of its job, which is it's raised that book above the fray of millions of other celebrity autobiographies, hasn't it? That's what it's known for. That's the tragic bit of the story, and you've got to have that. But I was, didn't they say? I think they say at one point in the evidence, they said they had to invent a new category of the best sellers to encompass the Barack Obama books because they sold so many copies. Now, there's two Barack Obama books, aren't there? Two main ones, I think.
They were massive
sellers. And have you read that?
19 or 20 million, something absolutely astonishing, wasn't it?
Have you read either of them?
No.
I haven't read either.
No, but it could be that the category is that for books that people buy but then never read. They just leave them lying around.
I think
they're meant to be really good.
They are meant to be really good. Now, I'm sure they will be really good. But, you know, how many people living down your road, a kind of average snapshot of the UK population, how many people do you think have read a political autobiography from start to finish?
Not many.
I would say not many. Surely. Think about it. Most people...
They certainly haven't read Liz Truss's. Liz Truss, after all that publicity, do you know what the sales...
2,000. I thought not bad.
320.
I thought not bad.
You thought that was not bad?
I thought not
but
bad.
But that publicity.
Well, it's like the publicity was all saying, this is terrible. And so if she still managed to sell 2,300, that's not terrible at all, you know. That probably means...
It can't be the opinion of her publisher, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know. They only paid her, you know. They paid her hardly anything. It was a small publisher. You know, it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a Tony Blair type, Boris Johnson type deal, you know, where they just add on the noughts. But it is.
The other parallel I thought was the thing about back catalogue. They were talking about those books that just keep selling. Don Quixote, Lord of the Rings, the Bible, Stephen King's Carrie, Very Hungry Caterpillar.
I bet.
It's been a bestseller for 19 years.
I bet.
The Twilight series, the novels of Colleen Hoover, that's the girl with the dragon tattoo, 50 Shades of Grey, those things. If you've got one of those, just...
She's not the girl with it. Is she the girl with the dragon tattoo?
I think
that's right.
I'm not sure about that.
But I thought Colleen Hoover was this... because I was talking to Sally, my publisher, about I was trying to find out what it meant by dark academia.
There's
a whole genre of publishing. Said, "Oh yes, it's very well done. Very well known." She said, "It's all part of book talk." And I thought, "What? What's book talk?" And then I started looking on TikTok, and books are huge on TikTok. You know, there's a whole strand of kind of what used to be called creepy weepy, I suppose, have been reborn as kind of gothic, you know, not quite thrillers, featuring female protagonists set against the ivy-clad walls of academia. You know, I mean, it's all stuff in the tradition of the Donna Tartt book, Secret History, or whatever, you know. All that stuff's all followed on. And people like buying series, don't they? That's the other interesting thing, is they don't just like to think of a one-off book. They like to think, oh, I'll buy that, and then I'll read another one, and another one. I've got on
which
line.
Which is another parallel with the record industry, isn't it? It's just collecting the set.
Getting
every record somebody made, you know.
I suppose, yeah. But the thing I always find amazing as an author is people get in touch with you. Blokes again. It's always blokes. No, it's not always blokes. This is what blokes always say, some blokes. I'm really excited about your book. I've ordered it, and I'm going to read it when I go on holiday. And you think...
Yeah.
If you're basing the book trade on the idea that people are, there's only a 2-week window every year
when people are actually going to read anything. I found the same thing. People writing to me and saying, I'm really excited about reading your book. When's it coming out in paperback? If you're excited,
yes. Restrain yourself.
It's only going to be £2 more anyway.
Yes,
you can't be that excited. You're going to wait for 18 months to save £2. You know.
Yes. And but I wonder if the kind of decline of commuting, you know, working from home at post COVID, has had any effect on book reading. It must have done because, you know, like I say, my wife's a teacher, and she goes across London and back every day, 5 days a week. She reads a lot of books at a time.
Yeah.
She reads more books than I do. Just because of the sheer concentration on doing it in that slot of the day, you know. Whereas if you don't commute, obviously you don't do it. Now, you've just returned from Greece.
I have.
And you made a very adventurous reading choice on the plane, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, Nick Hornby. You thought he was. I thought I'd reread because it was going to be a stressful journey, we thought, with the things going on at the airport. I thought I'd reread Nick Hornby's High Fidelity.
So it's not P.G. Woodhouse.
It wasn't P.G. Woodhouse, for a change. I don't know why. I just felt like some comforting read. And I remember reading it when it came out and thinking it was very good. It came out in 1995. I think it was quite good. I hadn't read it since. It is good. But the thing that struck me was that, I mean, A, did he ever work in a record shop? I don't know.
No.
I mean, Nick Hornby, huge, huge music fan, enormously knowledgeable. And the book, as anyone who's read it will know, it's broadly about music snobbery. Mm. That's what it's about. And it's about male and female tastes and people's different tastes. And it struck me that there were various benchmarks in 1995 when he wrote this for good taste. And he talks about Al Green, Solomon Burke, Aretha Franklin, Dusty Springfield, The Clash's Janie Jones, his favourite record, Richard and Linda Thompson's I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, Elvis Presley. And then the things that he flags up as bad taste, they go around, he and his girlfriend Laura go around to various people's houses and he looks through their record and CD collections and then kind of winces when he sees things like this. Tina Turner is considered to be the absolute rock bottom for him. Meatloaf, The Beatles, just absolutely frightful. Billy Joel, Kate Bush is anathema.
No, really?
What? Yeah. Mike Oldfield simply read The Pink Floyd. He finds absolutely unbearable. Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You, obviously. And Bob Marley, too. I thought that was just interesting. And I wondered if that idea of good taste had changed, because you wouldn't now say, you wouldn't dare announce, would you, that the Beatles were rubbish? And
no,
Kate
you wouldn't.
Bush was rubbish.
No, you
that
wouldn't.
Tina Turner or Bob Marley were rubbish. You simply couldn't do that as a benchmark for awfulness, or ABBA or whatever. So I wondered, I don't know what bad taste would be now. I think bad taste would probably be you too. Probably Sting, wouldn't it? But then Sting was probably bad taste then.
Yeah,
another thing
fine.
He talks about being absolutely terrible is Genesis. Because now Phil Collins is slightly fashionable, isn't he?
I don't know if he's fashionable, but he's more fashionable than Genesis. I'll give you that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something to do with things being ubiquitous here, isn't there? That thing about Tina Turner is when he cites Tina Turner there, he's talking about Private Dancer Tina
Turner.
Yeah,
no, he's talking about the 1980s, the late 80s Tina Turner.
And
he's
so,
not talking about Nutbush City Limits.
No, absolutely. And so there was a time when Private Dancer was completely inescapable.
Yeah. Yeah.
As was Meatloaf, as was Simply Red, you know, and so forth. And also, you saw these things in people's houses,
and
which
Pink
you
Floyd.
Don't anymore, do you?
Yeah, you don't.
You know, you at all. No, it's interesting to speculate whether, you know, popular music now has such a long shelf life, doesn't it? That it can sustain a period of being massively successful, nauseatingly ubiquitous, then slowly disappearing, and then slowly coming back. And so you start to hear people saying, possibly on podcasts, saying, do you know, I was listening to the new, I was listening to an old Simply Red album, and do you know, it's really good.
It's really good.
And then somebody else will say, yeah, you know, I know what you mean. The one I like is so-and-so.
Yeah. Can we talk in anything other than just whispers? Maybe it's all right to come out the closet and say we love this stuff.
And then the next thing you know, there will be a piece in the Times or something written by, you know, I don't know, written anybody, saying, you know, how I learned to stop hiding and declare my love of Simply Red to the world. Yeah. You know, and it starts
all
over again.
Which is what happened with ABBA. And it's what
absolutely.
Happened with Kate Bush, actually. And suddenly everyone went, oh, me too, I love them.
Yes, absolutely. But it's to do with that ubiquitousness is the source of of people's
intolerance.
Yeah, as
if they're blocking out the sun, as if they're blocking out the chance for any other music to get through.
Yes. That's the way it tends to feel. What else are we going to talk about? You've got Adam Clayton's garden you've been rather enthralled by.
And I was enthralled by that because my wife and I watch Gardener's World.
There you go.
We watch Gardener's World.
I've been listening to Simply Red.
Yeah, that's right. We watch Gardener's
World. It's
Confessions Week, isn't it? We watch Gardener's World. We absolutely love it. And they interviewed Adam Clayton. I thought just
is that Monty Don Gardener's World?
Monty Don, yeah.
Yeah, let me just kind of just stop you saying. Has your wife got a bit of a thing about Monty Don?
As has yours. Oh, God, we once went to a literary fest. I remember when Monty Don was signing hardbacks, and that was the biggest queue.
Oh, right.
It was infinitely bigger than any of the other literary authors. You know.
Can you just tell her from me that Monty Don follows me on Instagram?
Oh, no, really? That's exciting. I will. She'll be incredibly envious.
Carry on.
Did the thing about Adam Clayton's garden. And basically, you two had recorded the Joshua Tree in a place called Danesmote House in County Dublin. And at the end of this recording, it's fabulous old, slightly decaying kind of stately home with a 17 acres of landscape garden. Well, not all kind of run to ruin, actually. And they'd said to the band afterwards, look, this is for sale. If anybody wants to buy it, we'll let you have it. Knock off the cost of the rental for the recording of the album. And Adam Clayton, aged 27 at the time, bought it and just had this vision for creating this garden. And I thought it was quite interesting because you know nothing at all about Adam Clayton. Not a single thing. He did a couple of quite naughty things in the past, which I think have been erased from the records.
Didn't he take out his knob on the cover of...
he has, that's true. Yeah, on the cover of Acton Baby. That's right. That caused
Carry on.
I know. And they just showed this, and it was absolutely fantastic. It's a kind of George Harrison's Friar Park type thing, where for 30 years this guy's been planting trees and putting in bushes and landscaping and bridges and little streams and rivers, and it was just fantastic. And I thought it was just really amazing, and it's caused a huge sensation because nobody really knew anything about it, and nor did they know anything about Adam Clayton. It seemed such a solid thing to do. You think you go on those tours and you come back and wander around your own 17-acre garden. It must be pretty, what's the word, pacifying.
No, absolutely. Do they have that scheme in Ireland where people open their gardens one day a year?
They
ought to do that, didn't they? And he ought to open that and people can go in. And Alan Partridge shouting, Bono!
Bono!
Oh, what else? Last week when you were away, I was teaching young Alex about the Allman Brothers Band. You know, it was like, you know, a fisherman mending his nets down by the shoreline surrounded.
I heard it, I thought it was really good.
Apple cheeked young lad going, really cool, lummy.
Shiny faced youngster goes, tell me more, Grandpa. So who is this Dickie Betts?
We didn't get round to talking because we're mainly talking about the guitarists and the death of Duane Allman and Berry Gordy and so forth. And of course, since then, Greg Allman has died when did he die? In 2017. So, you know, Mark Allen, you interviewed Greg Allman, I think. And
huge.
Do you happen to know, I just thought I'd put this question to you. Do you know how many times Greg Allman was married, Mark?
I'm going to guess that it must have been, he married one girl twice, I think. It was in the five or sixes.
Seven.
No.
Seven. And
no
I'm
wonder
saying,
he was still working at the end.
And I'm going to whiz through them.
Oh, my
Lord. He married Shelley Jack K. Jeffs in 1971, divorced the following year. They had a son. He married Janice Blair in 73, divorced in 74. He then married, of course, Cher in 1975. Elijah Blue Allman.
The Seven Wives of Greg Allman.
There you go.
It's a little soap opera.
He wed Julie Bindus in 79. They had a daughter, Delilah Island, divorced 81. He married Danielle Galliano in 1989, divorced 1994. And then his longest marriage was to Stacey Fountain. He was married for 7 years, seven out-of-sight years, as he characterized them between 2001 and 2008. And then in 2012, he married Shannon Williams, who was 40 years his junior.
Oh, my God.
Now, seven marriages. Do you think that indicates the unsinkable power of the romantic urge as exemplified by Greg Allman? Or do you think he just kind of, he couldn't concentrate?
Well, in my brief experience of interviewing him, I would say that he was a very cantankerous individual indeed, actually. We fell out badly. I was talking to him about the notion of Southern rock, and there was a complete misunderstanding because I used the word Confederate. I went Confederate in the fabulous kind of Southern cowboy hatted sense, you know. And he got very, very outspoken about all this. He was extraordinary. He had unbelievable, very bad tattoos all over his arms. Really, but most of them had been self-applied. But no, he was good. And he talked about Richard and Linda Thompson's. Did you mention that too?
We may have done
the bright lights. I can't remember if you talked about it last week, because that's an anniversary, isn't it?
It's 50 years. It's 50 years next week, I think.
Yeah,
I'm right in saying. I've just written a piece for the New Statesman about it, and I realized in writing, I thought I'm sure I featured this when Paul Gambaccini did a book called The 100 Greatest Rock Albums or something like that in 1987. And he asked me to contribute. And
I've still got that somewhere, I think.
Okay. Did you contribute as well?
I
you
did.
Okay.
I'm really embarrassed, of course, by my...
I've got my... Oh, mine Lord. Is somewhere. Anyway, it's interesting. And this was at the time when... To be asked to do a thing like that, it was quite rare in those days. Nowadays, post-internet lists of great albums, whatever, they're 10 a penny, absolutely everywhere. Whereas at the time, they weren't. And to be asked to be, contribute your 10 in a book that was going to be actually in W.H. Smith's, you know, proper book. It was very thrilling. And so I did my 10, and I put Rich and Linda Thompson's I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight and number one. Consequently, when Paul, you know, put the whole thing together and calculated the overall list of 100, I think it came in at number 31 or something, all thanks to me putting it number one, you know.
I went for Bobby Bland's Dreamer, which is terrible.
Oh, right.
I mean, that was just obviously the record I was listening to that week and thought was just fantastic.
Yeah, it's fair enough. Nothing wrong with that at all, you know. There's no great science to this at all, you know.
No.
You simply talk about what you love about music, isn't it, really? And I suggested if Paul wants to do the book again in 2024, I'll probably leave it at number one. But I'm sure he doesn't, you know, because these things are absolutely everywhere.
I was remembering the sleeve note that Richard Thompson wrote for, I think it was an 8-CD reissue, and he complained about the lack of success of that record when it came out. He said that about Ireland, he said that they didn't understand Sandy Denny and they didn't understand Nick Drake. And I think we were slightly marginalised. What genre is this? Where does this go in the record shop? But actually, did it not sound like that?
I don't think that's true at all.
Richard Williams, who was the A&R guy, was the guy who actually got it and said, what have you got on the shelf for this? And we've got this Richard and Linda Thompson record. It's been there about a year. And heard it and said, we've got to put this out.
Absolutely. And I think that it was never easy to market things like that. But there was always a vague hope, you know, for about half a day, that the single might actually get on the radio it had a silver band on it. And, you know, people like things that got silver bands on them. But that wasn't to happen. And so, again, you know, that was the other interesting thing about what happened to records in 1974 when they didn't make it, is they just slid away. It disappeared from people didn't think about them anymore. You know, they were replaced.
No, there was
by
no way you could be reminded about them.
There's no way you could be reminded about them. It just slowly over a period of 50 years or whatever, people start talking about it, don't they? And I think I showed you that thing probably a couple of years ago when Mark Ronson put out his new version of it, didn't he, during lockdown. You know,
yeah.
He said only one song kind of embodied his desire to get out and party and so forth. That was I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, which probably indicates he was born into a music business family, wasn't he, in 1975. So they probably had that record around in the house, you know. But again, you know, records have incredibly long life nowadays, so they can disappear
for eternal life.
10, 20, 30 years.
No record ever completely disappears.
And then somebody from New Statesman gets hold of it, rings me up and says, would you write something about the 50th anniversary? I didn't even realize it was the 50th anniversary.
Very good. Sampled by Kanye West. Exactly.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. So
eternal afterlife.
Nothing goes away forever. So another break there, and then we'll be talking to birthday boy John Mantegna.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink, and it's like being in the pub.
And we're joined by our birthday guest, our much-valued Patreon supporter, John Mantegna. John, you're joining us as ever from where? Remind
from
us.
From Brooklyn,
from
New York.
From Brooklyn. How's the weather?
It is lovely. It is very sunny, as you can see.
Good.
Unseasonably cool. So it's a little deceptive. We'll think, oh, spring is finally here. We'll go outside a light jacket, and then everyone's shivering.
Yeah.
And then you bring a heavy coat, and then you're sweating, and nobody knows what to do. We sit outside in the coffee shops and lounge around, or do we bundle up and stay
so inside? So it's not true that the English are the only people who go on about the weather. It's the same thing absolutely all over the world, isn't it?
100%.
So, John, have you had your birthday yet, or is it?
Yeah, it was a week ago. Last Thursday, the 18th.
How was that celebrated?
Relatively low key, but also spread out over several days.
You had a festival.
Little bit. We dinner at home on the night of the 18th. Dinner out with some dear friends and family, just a small group of us. And then Sunday, my dad put on a big brunch. I share a birthday with one of my sisters. So there was a big to-do. You know, my dad hosted this big brunch with all of us, and my aunt and uncle were in town from England, actually. And so there was that. And then Amazon packages were, you know, I had gift cards and packages were arriving several days afterwards. So we kind of...
God, doesn't this make our birthday sound very modest, Dave? You haven't got to the age yet where you just want to get them out of the way quite
quickly. Just out of the way. I've forgotten about mine by lunchtime, usually, on the day.
But there's always some kind of record or CD that I'm pining for. So
what did you get? What did you get this time?
So I broke down and got the McCartney Archive edition of Wildlife.
All right.
I had been vacillating back and forth about whether I wanted that one, because I've always had mixed feelings about that album. But I am such an abject fan of that lineup of Wings. And I've gotten to talk to Denny Sywell a bunch of times. And I've played with Denny Lane a few times. And I have such a soft spot for the first lineup of Wings, the University Tour lineup.
Yeah. Yes.
And I got a big
in the van.
Yeah. And so it kept coming up on like other things you might like. And finally I just like, and
you gave it.
And there it was. Yeah. So I've started to kind of look through it, and I think it's interesting that the archive collection stuff, McCartney made the biggest packages out of the albums that were like the most misunderstood. While, you know, Band on the Run is like this big, Tug of War is this big, Red Rose Speedway is like it's like the size of a phone book. It's tremendous. And Wildlife as well. There's a lot of like there's a facsimile replica of Linda's notebook with like her lyrics and the chord changes written above it. I mean, they really did a job on that.
That really is detailed.
It's unbelievable.
That's going the extra mile, isn't it?
Yes. So it's traditional on these occasions that we ask our birthday guests to throw a conversational log on the word in your ear of fire. And you've got one, John. What did you
have? I have. So a couple of weeks ago, I was going through this collection by the Monkees called Listen to the Band. It was a four-disc set that came out in the, I'm not sure when, I can't see, the 1991. And so I was listening to disc three, and a song called Teardrop City came on that I hadn't heard in a very long time. Now, let me preface this by saying I'm probably the biggest Monkees fan you're ever going to meet.
Excellent.
My first concert was 1986, the reunion show. I've got all the albums. I've got the DVD set to the episode. I got to play with Mickey Dolenz for a little while on a 60s package tour many
That's
years
so
ago.
That's so nice to hear.
Yeah.
The lyrics to Randy Scouse Git are work genius, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, having said all that, anyone listening to Teardrop City, it was a single that came out in 1969, like near the end of their sort of trajectory there. Anyone listening to that song with both ears will tell you that it is a direct, shall we say, descendant of Last Train to Clarksville. Same key, same tempo, twangy guitar riff at the beginning. The melody is almost identical at the very beginning of it. I mean, it's clearly cut from the same cloth. And I hadn't heard that song in a long time. And when it came on, it really like was jarring, like, oh my God, that's Clarksville all over again. And I reflexively thought, like, you know what? That's never a winning strategy, is it? To just copy.
To do the same thing again.
To do that. And then I thought, or is it?
Or is it?
Well, and I began to wonder.
I've just been having this conversation.
Yeah. And I was.
The ink spots.
Yeah. Okay.
The ink spots surely are the greatest.
Have you ever listened to the greatest
hits? The name of four ink spots songs. And anybody listening who's got a spare 2 minutes, just get them up on Spotify and listen to maybe, just listen to the beginning of these, maybe, I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, If I Didn't Care, and Whispering Grass by the Ink Spots. They are not only are they
literally identical.
They're in the same key. It's the same thing listening to the same song.
Right.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering about that. I mean, and it's and I this is I know a couple of weeks ago you were having a conversation about artists with a narrow approach, like J.J. Cale. Everything he does has a. I'm talking specifically about like, because you have to think throughout music history, there's been moments where someone had a massive hit, and whoever it was, the record label, the management, whoever said that was great. Can you please give us another one that sounds like that?
That's obviously, it's always the same, you know, in anything. It's like in the book business. If you talk to the sales force, they always want the same thing again, obviously. You know, because the worst thing in the world is to go in with something that's wildly different. Right. And, you know, I've been looking into this morning a bit, and if you look at the Beach Boys, the early singles of the Beach Boys are Surfing, Surfing Safari, Surfing USA, and Surfer Girls. You know, they're not wildly different. You know, the first Jackson 5 singles, hits, are I Want You Back, ABC, and The Love You Say. It's the same record.
All the same, exactly.
It's the same record three times.
Of the Beatles. The first hit had a harmonica on it, and they were under immense pressure to make sure they always had a harmonica
on
the next few records, because that appeared to be the signature. Turned out it wasn't the signature at all, but that was what they were told to do.
Yeah.
I was also thinking about the Kinks, about You Really Got Me and All Day and
All of the Night. It's like the Stones and Satisfaction Get Off of My Cloud. Always felt to me as if they were cut from the same cloth.
Correct.
As if that Satisfaction was their breakthrough in the States, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so there was obviously pressure was on to, and they were doing things really quickly on the heels of the previous one in those days.
Right.
So it was probably same session, same studio, and so forth.
Yeah, there's also a track I wanted to point out. Mark Knopfler has a solo album called Golden Heart.
Right.
That's absolutely tremendous. And there's a track on here called Cannibals that it sounds like they said, you know, it'd be great if you could make another one that sounds just like Walk of Life by Dire Straits. And the same groove, and there's there's an organ riff at the beginning. I was like, oh, it's Walk of Life. Like something that grabs you right away as like, oh, they're clearly kind of doing that again.
But it's kind of, you know, the idea of people having a career and not doing exactly the same thing or again and again is right. a relatively recent kind of phenomenon, really, you know.
Right.
You know, if you know, I don't know, if you go back to the 30s or the 40s or, you know, or the 50s, you know, people did the same stuff, you know, again and again. I was just looking at another one I found is Elvis Presley, All Shook Up, is followed by Paralyzed. Same writer, right. same act, you know, it sounds the same thing. Another one I found, Tammy Wynette's follow-up to D-I-V-O-R-C-E is Stand By Your Man. But it sounds just the same. But right. You can't have the same sentiment. You know, right. you can have a directly opposite sentiment, but it's also, you know, it's about marriage. That's and so a more recent one I was thinking about was, well, it's not that recent, it's 40 years old, what we're talking about. Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Relax and Two Tribes. They're out of the same mold, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They are. Yeah. I think they're using some of the original recording sound bay that she's just blocked in the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think, there's some examples where they're not absolutely the same song, but they've just got such a similar sound. If you know those early Chuck Berry songs, they all sound very similar, I think.
Yeah.
As to the Sam Cooke, as to the Ramones, actually.
Yeah. Rick Astley, I think, is the same thing.
To them. You just think, I'm listening to the Ramones.
There it is.
You
know? But did Rick Astley ever, here's another thing. Did he ever have another really big hit?
There was a song called Together Forever.
Oh, of course there was.
That is very much like, that's Never Gonna Give
Me
Up.
Never Gonna Give Me Up.
With right. a few tweaks.
Right.
Same key, same tempo. I mean, as a musician, I'll notice if something is in the same key and some of the chord changes are the same. You know, I also, not to keep name dropping, but I toured for many years with Alan Parsons, with the Alan Parsons Live.
Oh, right, okay.
And he was telling me that after Eye in the Sky was such a massive hit, there was a deliberate attempt on the next couple of albums to have a doom, 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 some kind of song with like a chugging guitar riff in it.
I bet.
The Primetime on Ammonia Avenue and Sooner or Later on the Vulture Culture album, I think we're deliberately like, let's just kind of do a subtle Eye in the Sky thing.
That's reminded me of another one, Bo Diddley, the Bo Diddley beat, surely.
Well, right.
Bo Diddley beat is just, you know, it's absolutely similar on so many of them, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll tell you the other thing I was amazed to see. I went looking for One Hit Wonders to listen to the follow-up to see if they tried to do the same thing and it didn't work. Yeah. And I'm amazed at how many people had no follow-up at all. Vanilla Ice never got another top 40 single after Ice Ice Baby, which is quite remarkable.
Which was a huge...
When you consider how enormous that record.
Enormous, all around the world.
I remember that, sure.
All around the world, nothing at all. You know, just may as well just have given up at that point, you know. So the idea that people did manage to do it is extraordinary. Yeah. So do you think it's possible with your monkeys example that it was something that had been sitting around in the vaults for 2 years and then they thought, 369, try something that sounded like the early hit?
Well, so this is what's interesting. In between writing to Alex about this and doing it, I did some research. And it turns out Teardrop City was actually written and recorded like a couple of weeks or months after Clarksville.
But yeah.
And it sat in the can for a while. And it was also written by Boyce and Hart. I think Clarksville was like summer of 66. I think October of 66, they started Teardrop City, but then it was shelved. And in 69, when they were sort of like, you know, digging around in the vaults, that's when it sort of, came out. So my original premise that like 3 years later, they said, well, let's do another Clarksville. Turns out it had actually
they'd done it, but they hadn't.
Now's the time to put it out.
Because it will have been the sales force, like going back to my original point, saying, can you come up with a hit again? Tell you what, go and do something that's like what you did.
Give another one that sounds just like that.
Yeah, back exactly. in the day, you know, that's what the sales force always wants, you know.
Right.
What the sales force wants, the sales force in the end gets, you know. Right.
Does it always work, though?
No, it doesn't always work.
Right.
It doesn't always work, but it gives them a story to tell. I'm serious about this. I used to work in a record shop. And Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells comes out, you know, and it's obviously an enormous hit. And then there's Hergis Ridge, not as big a hit. And then there's the one after, not as big a hit.
On my daughter,
not as big a hit. And then after a while, they come in and they just have to say, do you know, it's his best since Tubular Bells.
Right.
Whether it sounds like it or not doesn't matter. It's a story to tell, you know.
Right.
Because everything's always, generally speaking, people are trying to recapture something, aren't they?
Seems that way.
Yeah. It's in the nature of success, isn't it?
Yeah.
The first one tends to be the biggest. And so there's always that pressure.
They do that with every Dylan album, don't they? It's a return to form.
You know? Right.
If you have a form you want to choose.
Yeah, they always say Rolling Stones, best since Exile at Main Street.
Exile at Main Street.
Say that. And I know every McCartney album that came out for years was like, oh, it's his best since Band on the Run.
Absolutely.
They never compared, oh, it's the best thing he's done since London Town.
You never
hear that. But one of you was saying that a while back about speaking to a music publisher and saying it's always one song.
Every
Breath You Take, I think you were.
Absolutely. And I've tested that theory on numerous songwriters.
Okay.
I said, is it one song? And they've all said, yes, one
song. It's the Golden Brown Factor.
It's the Golden Brown Factor.
Some really good Strangler songs, but that's the one that's chugging away now all over the world.
Yeah, it's
turning some money for all of them.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, there was a member who didn't even play on it or compose it. He still gets
a quarter of it.
Georgette Burnett.
Probably gets more than a quarter because two other members are dead now.
Right.
So he gets a half.
Do you not get a half if the others die?
Good work, Jean-Jacques Bernal.
Could be.
Good grief. Well, John, it's been fantastic. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you as well. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that topic with the people.
Oh, thank you. Sure. It's my pleasure. And thank you for keeping the show up. It really is
good. Well, we're very touched listening with such attention.
Absolutely.
Right. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
Thanks, John, very much.
All the very best.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.